Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. I am surrounded by the Taharka love and our sponsorship and our dear friends made right here in Baltimore at Taharka. This honey graham with the graham cracker swirl was made here. It's now in my belly. I've gone through about three or four of these since the sponsorship began. I think Don Moeller's doing the same thing over in Catonsville, where State Fair is serving it up, and they're about to open El Guapo across the street. I'm looking forward to my first pupusa in the 21228 State Fair there, doing it safely, socially distanced outside in Catonsville, as well as our friends at Fadley's, where you can still ship those delicious crab cakes. Talk about making an investment in the community. Fadley's coming to Catonsville as well, refurbishing an incredible space there. But right now, you want some Fadley's, you drop by Lexington Market, or you can ship them from anywhere in the world, Fadley's. And don't forget Moeller & Gary Realty. Jeff Moeller joined me. You can find that out in the buyatoyota.com audio vault up at WNST.net, talking all things real estate in the summer and buying and selling and these incredible interest rates that are really stimulating the marketplace. Don, how are you? This is a special one, right? I mean, I can't believe we're 250-some episodes into this, and you finally have invited one of your boss, your dear friend. We're finally getting around to the internal family here, Don, right?
It is indeed family. For a good 6.5 years, our guest and I probably spent more time with one another than we did with our family. So it is a real pleasure to welcome one of the just truly outstanding public servants in the history of the state of Maryland, former Baltimore County Executive Jim Smith. Jim, welcome aboard.
Oh, that's great. Great to be aboard. Thanks for having me, and great to talk to you, Don. And Nestor.
Well, you know what? I'm just glad you decided to come on, because at some point I was thinking, you know, if we don't get you in the first 250, when we call, you may just, like, sign a free agent contract somewhere else. You know, I was a little worried.
Worry not.
Well, I mean, in these sort of turbulent times and all of this, we always sort of begin with the first question, I think, in any plague or pandemic to any public figure. Hey, you had a playbook for everything. I mean, you certainly had crisis on your watch, and as a judge presided in front of tough cases. This is an all-timer, right? We've all lived long enough to see comets. We've now lived to see a pandemic, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously unprecedented, and it has, pointed out some of the flaws in our system to deal with something as universal as this is, because our country didn't deal with it universally. The president kind of passed the ball and dropped the ball, passed the ball, and as a result, it was really hard for local elected officials and state officials to coordinate and get what they needed in order to address the pandemic, which was here. And it's just a shame, but Maryland's done it better than most, and Baltimore County's done well, the city's done well. But they've had to take things on their own because there wasn't any unified approach to this countrywide dilemma.
Well, Jim, you know, we always say there's never a straight line on Baltimore Positive. It's certainly not 100% analogous, but roughly 1 year in to your term as county executive, the county was hit with one of its biggest tropical storms in history, Hurricane Isabel, basically wiping out much of the east side of the county. And at the time, you received rave reviews about your approach to that crisis. There were articles after articles written about how you simply rolled up your sleeve with your department heads and got to work. Walk our listeners who may not remember Hurricane Isabel.
That's the reason I live downtown, by the way. Flooded my basement in White Marsh.
2003, so. Right? I think we're talking.
Summer of 2003, absolutely.
Yeah, 2003. So, Jim, walk us through, first of all, as the storm was coming and then its aftermath, and then what approach you took to trying to get the county back up and running.
Well, the first thing you have to do is you have to appreciate the dimension of the issue. And the hurricane came in on a Thursday night, Friday morning, And on Saturday morning, I was in a helicopter going over eastern Baltimore County to kind of assess how bad the damage was. I didn't live in the eastern part of Baltimore County at the time, and therefore I had to find out. And when I did, the next day, and I really saw what people, frankly, didn't even realize at that point because they didn't have a bird's eye view like I did as to cars overturned and boats on the other side of the peninsula and boats that had gone through houses. And I mean, it was the people were really, once the shock of the whole thing would pass, were going to see how hard they had been hit. And I wanted them to make sure that they knew that their government understood that, and were going to step into the breach. And so on Sunday, I called all the department heads in for a 1 o'clock meeting. And
how many is that, by the way, Jim? When you say all the heads, what does that entail?
That's about 18 people. Once you get
and there's no department that's not affected, right? Like, it literally, when that sort of thing happens, it's across the board, right?
Well, Nestor, I'm going to interrupt the county executive for a minute and ask him to talk in detail about that, because as I got to know up close and personal working with Jim Smith, that was really his approach. And Jim, talk about that. There was no department unaffected.
Oh, there was no department. And what I wanted to do was I wanted to impress upon them how serious the situation was, and that I expected everybody to think about their own department and what could they do to alleviate the pain and the issues that the people in Baltimore County were going to be facing. And frankly, everybody came to the table, and I said, expense, we're not going to talk about expense. What we want to do is we want to make sure that the people in the county don't think they're alone in this crisis. We are with them, and we are going to demonstrate that we are with them. So Public Works obviously had the big equipment, and by that afternoon, we're in the neighborhoods and communities hauling away debris and things out of basements. And I mean, it was the sheriff's office. There was no way to communicate in eastern Baltimore County. They don't have good cell service. And so we had deputy sheriffs going door to door with flyers, giving them information as to where the crisis center was and things that they would really want to know, they being the people affected by this, would really want to know. Senior centers were using their buses, their senior transports to take people from homes that they couldn't stay in to shelters that we had established in eastern Baltimore County. Everybody was involved, and everybody had ideas as to how they could help, and it just went from there. And when we would go into the neighborhoods from that Sunday afternoon, all the way through the high point of the crisis, as far as debris and destruction is concerned, people would be absolutely just, you know, applauding us as we would come in, because I was working on getting. Personally, working on getting stuff out of people's basements and that kind of thing. We waived all the fees for the landfill. We got the State Department of Assessment and Taxation to give rebates on taxes because the premises weren't livable or the premises were gone. It was just, we tried to approach it from every aspect. In
Jim,
fact,
was there a playbook? I mean, was there a sort of the crisis management playbook? And then, as you point out, the unintended consequences of things that maybe weren't even in the first playbook that pop up that you then have to, you know, it's like whack-a-mole, I'm sure, right?
Yeah, well, we didn't really have a playbook for the hurricane specifically. Obviously, we had emergency management protocols, and they were followed, but this went well beyond what would normally be involved in an incident that was that was manageable or was smaller. I mean, this was all along the county shoreline, and that's 200 miles. So, I mean,
well, I guess what I'm wondering is Charleston's had hurricanes. I mean, all of these places that get hurricanes, I would think there's a before, during, and after sort of the way that they do it, or the way that they didn't do it in New Orleans, where this was obviously before New Orleans, but that we get better at doing this, right, as government, because the government people are going to change, but the system shouldn't, right?
Right, accepting that the system really didn't have anything as solid in place. In fact, FEMA began to copy us. In fact, told me, because we were dealing with officials at FEMA, that we were the poster child for how to respond to a disaster, and they were implementing that into their own program. I'll give you, for example, by Monday, we had selected the site for the crisis center and the command center in eastern Baltimore County. And we had already, now this is going to be run by FEMA, basically. We had, but we had made the selection, we got all the phone lines in, we had every station for information that people would need, local information that people would need, were set up. And when the FEMA officials arrived, they didn't come Monday, they came on Tuesday, they looked at what we had and they said, oh, well, you're ready to go. Well, we're not ready. We were just coming out to do a little survey to see what, you know, what, I mean, we were so far ahead, and frankly, to their credit, they appreciated it as opposed to resented it. So we got off pretty on a good footing with them too. They were a little tardy, but, they were very cooperative once we got going. So it was a situation that all hands on deck were required, and all hands on deck showed up, and they really did the job. There was a meeting later in the week at Sparrows Point High School for people to become aware of things that were available to help them get through the crisis. And I had all my department heads lined up, and so when they called on me to speak, I introduced all my department heads. And when I got to the director of public works, now this is a crowd that was frustrated, angry, scared. Many of them were eating their dinner in the because it was a 6 o'clock meeting. In the hall, and when I introduced my director of public works, he got a minute standing ovation from
wow,
that crowd.
That's incredible.
And I mean, it was a beautiful thing to behold, quite frankly.
Former Baltimore County Executive Jim Smith is our guest. Former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller is our co-host. Don, I'll leave it to you, because when you talk about the living through it and doing it, and then there's what's going on that you and I lament, and I'm sure Jim laments as well, about what's not happening in government right now during a time of crisis.
Right. And Nestor, before we get to that, I want the former county executive to talk a little bit about follow-up as well, because one of the things that happened, Jim, was that once the storm came and went, people then, and Nestor, I know this is what interests you, is in terms of how government really works and gets to the bottom of issues, people were having trouble with insurance. And you hired the former insurance commissioner, Steve Larson, to do a report. Maybe talk about what led to that process. And what led you to do that sort of after-action review?
Well, it became pretty evident pretty early that the appraisers that were going out and assessing the damages to homes were really lowballing their appraisals. And people who had, say, $250,000 worth of insurance, so it wasn't a question of the damages exceeding their limits, were getting just minimal appraisals to repay them for the damage that they had experienced, which was far more extensive than the appraisals would reflect.
Well, this is where the judge in you comes out, right?
Yeah, a little bit. And I like fairness. You know, that's a premier quality of the judiciary.
You know what? I want to be honest with you. As a citizen, I hope that you love fairness as a judge. You know, I hope they all do. I hope, you know, right? But I don't feel that way always as a citizen.
Okay.
So.
Well, in this instance, I felt deeply about the circumstances, and I went to the insurance commissioner and asked him if he would intercede, and I didn't ask him formally, but I reached out, and he had already announced that he could do nothing for the people, and which was really a blow to their confidence and to their hopes, to be honest with you. So in any event, this was a pattern of low-balled appraisals. Denying damages that were covered by their policy. I mean, it was a mess, to be quite honest with you. And maybe some of it was because there were so many appraisals to be done, but that really didn't excuse what was happening. So as Don said, I knew that I was going to have some expertise behind the position that they were really excluding things that shouldn't be excluded, and that they were lowballing in connection with the things that they were even allowing recovery for. So Steve Larson was perfect. I had to get him under $25,000 because I couldn't hire him because the council wasn't quite on board with me at this point. They didn't think I should be getting involved in a federal issue, and it was an issue that was of critical importance to so many people. So in any event, Steve came in and was agreeable to doing that, and so I had the authority up to $25,000 to hire him. And what we did was we agreed to have county people under his direction do a lot of the data gathering, so that we took some of the expense of doing this kind of report off of him. Anyway, we got the report, and then I had to go to Washington to meet with the deputy director of FEMA, and I was a little nervous. I would have loved to have had the insurance commissioner with me, but it didn't work out that way. So we went over and ended up going three different times to D.C. to meet with FEMA. And then I had already involved Senator Sarbanes, who was the senator at the time, and Senator Mikulski. And Sarbanes was on a committee that was very important to FEMA. So he helped immensely to get me some attention. And as it turned out, the FEMA ordered all of the appraisals in eastern Baltimore County to be redone by other appraisers. And awards were coming in three times what had originally been assessed in the first round of appraisals. So people, you know, could actually rebuild, could actually repair, and it was very satisfying. In fact, Senator Sarbanes included some of what we learned in that process with FEMA in legislation that renewed the FEMA program. So we ended up really making a difference. But it was something, you know, if I had just done nothing, that the folks would have had to, on an individual basis, tried to take on FEMA themselves. And I had enough trouble taking on FEMA as the county executive of Baltimore County. And I certainly wouldn't have wanted individual homeowners to have had to have tried to go through what I went through. So it really was a complete package. And when I say the county responded, everybody responded and everybody contributed to the recovery. And then we celebrated the recovery with a waterfront festival and had 20,000 people show up to the comeback and the resiliency of Baltimore Countyans was really celebrated in a big way, and it was a grand event. And I had a big party for all the employees in Baltimore County that had been involved in the recovery from the various departments, and it was, you know, we did some celebrating at the end, but it was not easy getting there.
Well, I mean, obviously you had to go to the federal government a couple of times. Not every county executive would do that. Not every leader would do that. I guess I would say, why did you do that? The greater thing would be maybe you felt like it was in the purview of your job and felt like as the judge these people had been wrong, but not everybody would do that, right?
Well, I don't know. I would hope everybody would do that in the position of being the elected leader of your jurisdiction. But in any event, I really had I had no choice. I mean, I was surprised that I didn't have more support from the county council at the time. They ended up eventually climbing on board, but initially they didn't, and which is why I had to get somebody for under $25,000 because that's the max that the...
I'm just smiling here, sitting in my office, thinking about first year and a half wasn't all a bed of roses there, was it?
No. Some of the council members thought that I had a very good job when I was on the bench, and I should have stayed on the bench. And if I had stayed on the bench, they would be the county executive. And so they didn't really appreciate my role at the time. We patched it up and moved on. But that was early on in my tenure, and so I had my challenges there.
But as you said, it all ended well. You know, you mentioned, we always talk again, we zig and zag here on Baltimore Positive. You mentioned your career on the bench. And Nestor, I don't know that you are even aware of this, but County Executive Smith was involved in one of the important murder cases ever in the history of the state, probably in the history of the nation, in the exoneration of Kirk Bloodsworth. Bring our listeners up to date. I mean, we're talking about a gentleman who was convicted back in March of 1985, served 8 years for murder, and ends up being exonerated on DNA evidence because of a little decision that Judge Jim Smith made. Walk us through that.
Well, the case had been tried before I was appointed to the bench, but it went up on appeal, and he was convicted of murder and given the death sentence. And it came back, and I was assigned the retrial of the case. So I retried it, and then the jury convicted him again, and then he was given a life sentence without parole. But I think it was just a life sentence. I'm not sure if without parole was available then. In any event, but he had gotten the death penalty in the first trial. So he appealed the second trial, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and it was never reversed. And so it was pretty much over. And the clerk's office came up to me. This was probably 2 years after I retried it in 86, I think. And this was like 88 or so. And so the clerk's office brought the evidence up that it had been introduced into trial, and said, what are we supposed to do with this? And I said, well, what do you do with all the evidence from other cases? And they said, well, we don't always keep it. We put it in some of it. We put in storage. What do you want? I said, look, just give me the evidence. I'll put it in this closet in my courtroom. I'll lock it, and we'll just leave it in there. And then 2 more years later, practically, the group that from D.C. that go for...
Right, the famous the movie that's out now, exactly.
Yeah, right.
I don't see movies. Don knows this, so I can't give you any help.
Well, in any event, the Justice Project, I think it's called, they came over to the courthouse, and unbeknownst to me, were down in the clerk's office, and they were asking for the evidence, because one of the pieces of evidence was a pair of this was a murder rape of a 9-year-old girl, and her panties were one of the items of evidence. So they wanted to get that, because although DNA wasn't evidence or testing wasn't available when he had his trial, it was now available, and they wanted to submit it for testing. And the clerk's office said, we had no idea where it is. You can go up and talk to the judge, but we don't know where it is. And so they came up, and before it even got to me, I think they ran into my law clerk, and he said, oh, that evidence? Yeah, I know where that is, in that locked closet in the judge's courtroom. That's where that is. And so it was there. I gave it to him, and then that's when the testing was done, and it was determined that it was somebody else. There was no DNA match to the defendant in the case, and ultimately he was brought back to court, and I released him from in prison. And then from that, he became a real advocate against the death penalty, and really was testifying all over the country, quite frankly. Why did I save the evidence? The only case that it was ever presented to me, frankly, the good Lord intervened. I have no idea why I said to do that, excepting that it was an important. It was just kind of automatic. It wasn't. I had never been asked about it before. But when they asked, I said, "Well, we won't destroy that evidence," and so we saved it. And I'm getting more credit than I'm due. I don't know why the clerk's office came to me, because they'd never done that before, and they never did it afterwards. But in any event, it all worked out, and the exoneration was a long time coming, I'm afraid. I think he was in jail for maybe 7 or 8 years.
Yeah, eight years,
yeah,
I think.
Right.
And
when
you've been asked that, I've heard you respond to that a number of times. You've been asked, what on earth made you say, you know what, I think I'll hang on to that evidence? That's not necessarily typical. I think you and many other judges would say, I'm going to do whatever you typically do with it. You throw it away, you burn it, do whatever. But there was something that made you say, I'm going to hang on to that evidence. And then a man eventually walks out of prison because of that decision. It's one of the most fascinating cases in the state of Maryland. But what I want you to talk a little bit about, Jim, is that you indicated, and again, you and I have talked about this next issue a lot over the years. You said, you know, all I can tell you is I think the Lord intervened. Mm-hmm. And in your case, we just had Michael Steele on. And Michael Steele talked very openly about his faith. He at one point had contemplated going into the priesthood, actually went to the seminary. I know that as a young boy, you had looked at the priesthood as a really admirable career and had thought about it. Talk to us, our listeners, about the role that faith has played in your life.
Well, it's played a gigantic role in my life. Number one, I went to Loyola Blakefield. It was just Loyola High School in my day. And the Jesuits pounded into you the service for others, a man for others, and it's now people for others, and their curriculum wasn't filled with it, but we got that idea in even some of our theology courses. And then I went to a Jesuit college, and one of the reasons I wanted to go to a Jesuit college was because of the way education was presented in high school, with, you know, with responsibility and with morality, and so I ended up going to Wheeling Jesuit University in West Virginia, and again the same type of service orientation was throughout the my experience there. And
men for others, right?
Yep, that's what it is. And frankly, I know it was funny. Right before graduation, I was sitting in one of the rooms with my best friend, and we were talking about, what do you want to do now that, you know, you're going to graduate? And I said, well, okay, what do you want to do? And he said, I want to be a cardiac surgeon. I said, that's great. And he said, well, now what do you want to do? And I said, I didn't. I had taken the LSATs, and was going to go to law school, but I didn't know exactly what I was going to do. And so I said, well, I want to do the greatest good for the greatest number of people. And he said, that's not a career. And yet it was a career because basically, other than the 17 years when I was in the private practice of law, I've been involved in public service for the rest of my life. So even before that, I was involved in a lot of community stuff through what was then known as the JCs, and I enjoyed that kind of work.
Well, Jim, that's not the first time you said the person told you that that's not a career choice.
Right.
It's not the first time somebody told you you had a crazy idea that actually ended up being true. And I want you to recall for our audience when you decided to run, and Nestor starts his segment by talking about all these great, incredible restaurants, that there's been this rebirth, for example, in Catonsville, one of our older revitalization areas in the county, and you at that time had as your communication consultant a woman that's gone on to be very famous as one of Barack Obama's communication gurus, Anita Dunn, who now is a senior advisor to Vice President Biden. And tell her, you told her you were going to run on what was that word again?
on Renaissance. What happened?
Her reaction to that?
Oh, her reaction to that. This was the first time I met her. She came over to my headquarters in Reisterstown, and so she sat down. She's very businesslike, and she said, okay, now I want you to tell me why you want to run for county executive. And I said, because I want to lead a renaissance of Baltimore County. And she immediately said, oh, no. We cannot use that. People don't even know how to spell it. And I said, I don't care whether people know how to spell it.
We're going to teach them how to spell
They're going to know how to say it, and we're going to tell them what it means. This is the reason I resigned from the bench, to run for county executive. We're not going to drop this, so let's move on.
And you won the argument.
Oh, yes. We moved on.
You know, I love a strong idea. You know, when people try to talk you out of your own idea, that's your own inspiration, that's when things get a little weird. That's when Jim Smith starts to get handled as a politician, correct?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, he does. He's not a big fan of being someone in the room a lot, Nestor. Not a big fan of being handled. I will tell, Nestor, I'll tell you a Jim Smith story, and I don't know if he'll even remember this, but probably, you know, people assume that Jim and I knew each other going way back, which we didn't until I went to work for him in, I guess it was 2003, because we became such good friends and spent such time together. But
he didn't have the good fortune of having you in 1982 as a high school guidance counsel like
no,
I did.
No, he did not.
No,
I did not. He a little brief.
Look at how I turned out, Jim. Look at it.
Listen, a lot of people turned out real well with me. He has more people walk up to him if he and I are together.
Well, you're just in Catonsville. That's what it is.
But anyway, we were there. I was there for about a month. And I had said, I came home one day and said to Linda, this is really fascinating. And actually, I went into the county executive's office the next day and asked him to elaborate. And there were two or three times, I don't want to exaggerate how many there were, two or three, where Jim Smith could have chosen door A and door B. And neither one were a bad choice, but door A was probably a politically easier choice. Door B probably was the better choice, but you could have gotten less grief by choosing door A. And every single time, Jim Smith chose door B. He chose the door that was the absolutely right thing versus the one that might have been a little easier. And I went in the next day, and boss, I don't know if you remember this, I said to you, educate me a little bit, because this political thing is new to me. I'm just getting my feet wet here. I said, I gave you that scenario, door A, door B, and I asked you, why you chose door B, and do you remember your response? I don't even know if you do.
I think I do.
He's told me this story a couple of times off the air, so I hope you give me the right answer.
I think I said doing the right thing is good politics.
Always. You said over the years, and boy, it's amazing. And this will get us into the national discussion that I know Nestor is chomping at the bit to get you to talk about. But it's amazing to me, Jim, how people lose sight of that, because that was such a core of your belief system that you said, you look at me and say, Don, here's what I've learned over the years. If you do the right thing, inevitably it turns out to be good politically.
Yeah.
So let's just do the right thing. So, Nestor, I'm going to turn you loose on the national political scene now. It's your time.
Well, it's not even as much about that as it is going back to sort of the judge roots, because that's where I wanted to begin the conversation with you, which is about, you brought up fairness. What is fair is innate in you. And I think I said to Don early on in one of our conversations, my father was like a square deal guy. Now, Venatulis didn't like us because we campaigned against him with Coulihan back in the 70s. So we got sideways a little bit with him. But my dad just believed in like fairness and government. And you were a judge in trying to discern in front of you who's lying to you and who's telling the truth. And there's paperwork and signatures and he said and she said and witnesses. And in every case, for you, facts matter and evidence matters. And I think we've gotten a long, long way in this country from people looking at something and knowing when the Russians have written it and put it in front of them, and when it's true and when it's not true. I think that that's something that maybe it speaks to your background, education, or where you came from, but being able to see sides is something we've really sort of lost sight of as a society, I think, Jim.
Well, one thing you have to do is you have to listen to the facts, and you have to make a note of them. One of the things that I did in order to make sure that I would stay in every case is I took copious notes, and it helped me so many times, quite frankly, including, if you have a 3 or 4 day trial, and then closing arguments, and the lawyers start telling you what the evidence is. And so many times I would respectfully interrupt the lawyer and say, you know, I have notes on this, and that isn't the way the evidence went. And they would go, oh. Because I didn't have to rely on my own memory, because as Don knows, my memory is not that good. But in any event... But my notes are very good, and I had, it's funny, my successor, Judge Ruth Jacobowski, who is a terrific judge in Baltimore County, she inherited my file cabinets of notes from all my trials, and one of the reasons that she kept them was because another thing I did was on criminal cases, when I would sentence somebody and then put them on probation at the end of the sentence, where I'd defer the sentence beginning to be undertaken and put them on probation immediately and see how they did, and then I would maybe suspend the rest of the sentence so that they could continue doing well as they were doing. And I would write in the margin my impression of the defendant and what I anticipated he or she might do, or if they did this, I want to do this, because I knew I would not remember those kinds of details if I didn't make a note of them. So I did that, and when she got, and I told her about that, I said, look, you don't have to obviously pay any attention to what my impressions were or what I intended to do, but I did write him in the margin. Well, she kept all of my files and just told me about a year ago. Now, I've been off the bench since 2010, so that's 10 years. And about a year ago that she finally threw away all of my notes. She said, I had the last defendant that you had. And so all my notes in civil cases and criminal cases and administrative appeals, whatever it was, they all went out and were discarded finally, but that's 10 years after I left.
So Nestor, you will.
I took a lot of notes.
I was good. Nestor, you because you love to write, I think it is safe to say that the former judge and former county executive is one of the champions of the red pen. So if you were a speechwriter for the county executive, you had to have very thick skin because it was coming back with more than just one or two slight revisions. And Boss, tell Nestor one of my favorite stories, because Nestor, you obviously like the judge stories, and the two police officers who obviously were not familiar with your desire to actually read something if you were going to sign it, when they got you out of bed in the middle of the night one time and you came down in your pajamas and they wanted you to sign the warrant. That, recount that story for us.
Well, I knew that they were working hard, et cetera, but they didn't have in the probable cause for the warrant stuff that when I followed up verbally with them, they actually had the information, but they hadn't put it in the warrant application. So I would interlineate, and they would initial various adjustments. And this one set of detectives said, you know, we've never had a judge do that to our warrants. They either sign them or they tell us to go back and redo them. I mean, we've never had anybody
write it up
in the middle of the night with right. the judge yeah. in his pajamas.
So sometimes I would be up there for an hour, hour and 15 minutes while I was trying to straighten out a warrant that it was a good application, but it wasn't written to keep all the information that they needed in the application itself. So, and then sometimes I would tell them they had to go get more information, but not that often. I mean, they really did generally a good job. So it wasn't a question of that. But you know, I didn't want to inconvenience them because it's 3 o'clock in the morning for them as well as for me, and to go back to the station to retype it, to come back, it just, you know, it didn't make sense to do that. So I would do this interlineation stuff, and they would sign it, and then I would initial it, and then we'd go and finish up, and I'd sign the warrants or whatever, and off they'd go, and with as little interruption to the...
Well, maybe we could do that on DocuSign in the modern era.
Before we get out of here, give us your take on the Trump presidency to this point. And you certainly have said to me off the air, like so many others, you don't think it's an exaggeration to say that the election on November the 3rd is the most important of our lifetime. Share with our listeners why you see it that way.
Well, some of your listeners aren't going to like hearing this, but I think that...
Nestor doesn't mind that.
Okay, all right.
You know why? Because we believe in fairness and truth here, because I still like facts.
Yeah.
Let's go back to facts.
Yeah, and you know something? The media is just, in my opinion, starting to really confront President Trump with his misstatements of fact and with his outright lies. I mean, he just had an interview with Chris Wallace. And Chris really challenged him with facts. And that's something that should have happened 5 years ago, quite frankly. And because, you know, the one thing I told my kids was, the one thing don't get involved in is lying, because if you lie and you are become known as a liar, nobody will know whenever to believe you. You may be telling the truth, but they might, because of your penchant for lying, might not know that. And so you're really, you can't be believed on anything when you become a liar. Well, that's what we've had. And he's dangerous, and I think he's evil, but he's a very dangerous person. And it's critical for our country. It's critical for our country that we stop this, we learn from it, and we move on with a totally different moral attitude. And I'm not talking any particular religion at all. I'm just talking about general morality and appreciation of human beings. We've got to move on, and we can't possibly take another 4 years of what we've had over the last 3.5 years. So I do think it's a critical election. I have this hope that he will really be drummed out of office, but he might not. I mean, popular vote-wise, he will probably. Electoral college vote, I don't know. But I think there's a really good chance that finally his emperor with no clothes has been exposed, and maybe we will get the kind of turnaround that frankly we need to prove that to the rest of the world. That he was repudiated, because I mean the rest of the world in large measure have no idea what the hell's going on.
They're not letting us in. Linda can't go to France right now. I can't even go to Toronto.
Yeah.
Major League Baseball can't go to Toronto, right?
Right. There you go. I mean,
we have worthless passports. It's insane.
Yeah. It's just, we have so far to go. I think the pandemic, along with the Black Lives Matter, have really awakened many people in our country to the reality of what black life is in America and how important and essential black life is to our lives. Because a lot of the black employees are the bus drivers, are the cleaning staff, not all, but many of them are cleaning staff, the retail clerks, the stock that stock the shelves of grocery stores. We've come to realize how important these people are to the quality of life that we all enjoy, and with the rapid murders that occurred with the police, it just, you get an appreciation of what, if I were a black man, for example, what I would have to contend with as I leave my home. You know, am I going to get stopped for a traffic ticket, or is it going to be worse than that? You know, when you really feel it, it hurts. And let's face it, a lot of our country have been hurting for a long time, and it's to our advantage if they do well. We have to build the wealth in the lower income brackets of our country, and we have to grow it. I mean, for example, Baltimore City can't import a middle class. They can import some into the middle class, but they have to grow out of the people who are there. We can't drive people out of their homes, and we have to help them become part of a strong middle class.
No, well, it's a human capital issue. We have people.
Yeah.
How do we make everyone useful and valuable and have them feel value in themselves?
Yeah, well, value in themselves, but also we recognize the value they are to us. I mean, let's face it, the clerks that were stocking the grocery shelves that I went in to get the food from were pretty important. If the shelves were empty, I'd be in a pretty bad way. And that's true in so many respects. I think we've learned that people on all stratas of society, doing all strata of employment and jobs, it takes all of us. It takes those people in addition to us, because we don't make it on our own. We make it through the combined efforts of everybody contributing to society in the best way they can. And frankly, I think that I'm hoping that that's opened eyes and we can move mightily fast in the next few years in writing our country's legacy of discrimination and bias. I'm optimistic, and the pandemic has shown, you know, how essential so many people that we might not have thought were essential before are.
Former County Executive Jim Smith, our guest, along with former County Executive Don Mohler. Don, we're going to show it to the next time. We'll save the red line and transportation for the next time. How about that? We'll do that next time around.
We're gonna have the former County Executive, former Judge, former Secretary of Transportation back on to become a regular on Baltimore Positive. Nestor, I've said to you over the years, just an awful lot of good people in public service, despite what people think, and really none better than former Baltimore County Executive Jim Smith.
Okay. Jim, we appreciate you. Thanks for coming on.
Okay, thank you, guys.
You got it. Jim Smith, Don Mohler, all of our Baltimore Positive broadcast brought to you by our friends at Taharka. I'm holding the vanilla bean here because I can't get the wake and bake and the mint flicks and chills. Sweet vanilla ice cream with a flex of vanilla beans. I was going to bring some butterscotch home and dump it over top of that delicious Taharka made right here in Baltimore, Maryland. And our sponsors, of course, at State Fair and Catonsville. It'll be nice to get together with the former Baltimore County Executive Jim Smith over some shrimp and grits or some chicken and waffles. Maybe even go over to El Guapo and take in some pupusas once Evan Brown gets that open over in the 21228. Our great sponsors at State Fair and at El Guapo. Also, Fadley's, don't forget shipping those crab cakes. You know how good they are. They're world famous for a reason. We could ship them all over the world. Go to Fadley's Restaurant. We're going to have Damie back on next month as well to tell us more about the Catonsville update there and all that is going on to rebuild a bigger, better Lexington market. And they're still down there for you, our partners at Fadley's. We miss them tremendously. I specifically miss that mac and cheese right now, I'll tell you. Mohler and Gary Realty still selling homes, still listing homes, still getting deals done. Jeff Mohler told me all about it. All that's up in the buyatoyota.com audio vault, and you can find them at MohlerandGary.com. On behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Mohler, I am Nestor Aparicio. We are Calm, Local, and WNST.net AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking Baltimore Positive.